Hey guys, welcome to the Science Slot Machine. We have a lot of exciting stuff for you on this episode, and in fact, we decided there was so much stuff that we had to split this episode once again into two of them. And so, in this first part, we're really excited we were able to bring on a really cool interview guest, our own professor at the Department of Science and Technology Studies, Uli Felt. In the first episode, you're going to hear our interview with her, and in the second part, we're going to discuss the topic a little bit more. And in this episode, as the title might indicate, what we're going to get into today is about plagiarism, scientific misconduct, and loads of other stuff. And we're really going to hash it out. There's some really big debates in this episode. And then in the second episode, we're really excited that we're able to bring on a new team member to our group. Nora's going to join us for our second episode, and we're really excited to have her on the team. So congratulations, team. We're now a foursome again.
Welcome to the Science Slot Machine.
Brought to you by students of the Science, Technology, and Society Master's Program at the University of Vienna. In this podcast, we explore topics from the very notable to the very niche.
We always keep an eye on how science, technology, and society relate to one another in various aspects. We discuss hot topics, but also suggestions by you.
Check us out on social media and be sure to send us your topic suggestions to science.machine@gmail.com.
Hey guys, so today we have a very cool interview and we're excited to introduce to you University Professor Ulrike Felt, well, our university professor, actually, at the Department of Science and Technology Studies at the University of Vienna. Uli, thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview with us. We've had a lot of hot topics in the news lately on scientific misconduct, and we thought that we would ask you to join the show.
So, Ulrike Felt, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you. The first question is, how are you actually doing these days?
I'm doing fine, whatever fine means nowadays. But given the circumstances, I think I'm doing fine. Otherwise, work just goes on as usual within universities. It's more the students that are suffering from these things, and we're having to rethink how we can engage with each other in new ways.
So lately, we have been talking so much about scientific misconduct. And when we actually discuss these things about scientific practice, about plagiarism, about cheating, we always seem to only focus on calling out scientific misconduct. And we never really seem to shift the conversation into what makes scientific research good. So we actually thought we'd kind of start off this interview by flipping the script and asking you what makes good scientific practice.
Yeah, that's a very nice question, actually, because indeed we do not explicitly talk about these things. Of course, we discuss generally, there are basic rules and things like that, but there is never anything like a profound discussion over what makes science, in that sense, good science at the end of the day. In the university world, or even in the scientific world, more largely speaking, we measure the quality very often by the success of a publication or so, but we don't speak about the practices themselves. And I think that's a very interesting observation in itself, that we seem to have to assume that everything goes well, and only if it doesn't do so, we think it's necessary to speak about that publicly. This is not unproblematic, because this allows science to have this very woolly and fuzzy character that thinks it's all about objectivity and people are totally disinterested, and it's only about pure knowledge or things like that, because we don't speak about it. And I think this is a really good question to ask: what makes good practice? And it's actually challenging to define that, but I think if one carefully thinks about how do I do research, then there are these things like, I don't know, carefully crafting what it means to have an interest in a question. So to think about, to position yourself with what has already been done and where would I like to go to make that explicit, to have a form of self-critique in a sense of question some of the intuitive first ideas you have, whether or not they would hold when you look a second time or a third time, or that you are more or less transparent about why you make choices, et cetera, et cetera. Or good science for me is also, maybe I would, in the social sciences, I would say it's caring for the subjects with which I'm working. So if I do interviews or so, to think also about what does that do to the person to whom I speak, or even, and then finally, I think it's a certain kind of openness to be surprised. And I think sometimes when you're so much on track of something and you want to deliver a response to something you are really after, there is a tendency to be closed too early and to not be ready to see things that are not obvious. And I think all these things, these little things together, make for me good science. And of course, then you can add, oh, you have to know your methods. But these are the more the defined things. You can teach that students. You can say, okay, this is the way you have to do, etc. But the qualities I just named are much more these soft qualities, maybe one could call them. So the kinds of things you have to think about and have a feeling towards when you do research. And I think actually many of these things take time. And time is something which we rarely discuss in the public arena when we speak about science. Knowledge often seems to fall from heaven somewhere. And that explains also why people are disappointed when they have a problem and then they turn to science and science cannot give a ready-made answer. Then they get very upset and say, I mean, my goodness, why do we have all that science if they don't have a response? And I think the corona debates in the beginning were a wonderful example that people expected a kind of science that has never existed and will never exist. But as we don't discuss about the difficulties and challenges of work, et cetera, this is absent. So, yeah, so I think it's a good way to start with what is a good scientific practice.
Who should actually decide what is good scientific conduct and what is bad scientific conduct? So where does the responsibility lie, so to say?
This is a really big question at the end of the day. At the end of the day, science is always a collective enterprise. And we could go back and say any kind of knowledge is actually a collective enterprise. You don't know on your own. You always are in a community in which you kind of develop your thoughts, you refer to other kinds of knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it has always been and will always be a collective thing to define what good science is. And now the question is more to ask, how can we make it transparent what good science is and how can we make it actionable in that sense? So how can we teach people or even in transgression cases? So when people go across the boundary, which is normally seen as, oh, that's a no-go in science. But the question is like, how do you learn that? How do you get that feeling? And I think this is really important to learn that in the daily environment in many ways of doing research. And of course, this is only possible if you collaborate and if other people see what you do and you are transparent about what you do, then you can learn about how to do it. So it's collective, first of all. And so it's in general the scientific collective. For a very, very long time, I would say until the 1980s, most probably, most of these rules were never made explicit. So they were always existing in implicit manners, being taught by teachers to students. So you have these apprenticeship relationships where this was handed on. And actually, only in the 80s, you see the emergence of more and more concerns about how science is working. And that is interestingly tied to the fact that science becomes more present in society, is demanded for, is expected to deliver for societal problems and concerns. The whole innovation talk starts, et cetera, et cetera. So all this taken together makes also a shift and a concern that if science does not deliver along a certain quality imaginary, I call it now, then its credibility, its trust, and its power would be lost. And there we see the first rules and regulations appear, and they need to formalize it. Now, it's interesting how they are formalized, because generally they have these big principles. And then I can always ask the question, but what does that mean in practice? So, for example, you say, no plagiarism. Okay, but then you can say, where does plagiarism really begin? So if I change just a bit of things, is that already plagiarism? How much do I have to change that it's new? And this is really what I would call a borderland. So these are cases. It's not a sharp line. It's a fuzzy area in which you navigate. And there are always debates. And that's why universities have also over the 80s, in most countries, created bodies that take control over cases of allegations, I have to say, that somebody transgressed a rule of good practice. And then these bodies have to engage in a discourse over along which lines is that a transgression. And this is a question with the scientific community. And of course, it's getting more and more legalized also. We try to define these kinds of things. But and of course, also science has changed along the way. So, for example, with the internet, new kinds of problems have appeared. So before the time of the internet, copying by hand from other people's books were much less attractive than it is today to simply make cut and paste. And some people even forget about that they have cut it and they have cut and paste. So it's not even sometimes deliberate, but sometimes it's even the slippery slope that it's so easy to do that. So as the knowledge is a community thing, also the rules and regulations of what is good practice and what is a transgression is always within the community itself. And that's why in many countries, not in all, but in many countries, it's not a legal issue, but it's something that is internal to the university and can, in worst case, make you lose your job. But it's not something that can bring you to prison or something like that. There are countries that deal with major cases of scientific misconduct, even with penalties of that kind.
Well, what I noticed in this answer is it seems, you know, when you look at the idea of scientific misconduct, that there's a whole bunch of things here for STS scholars to really look at. There's on the one hand, the idea of just knowledge production. Then there's the other hand with just the scientific community and the complex and all the problems that are associated with that. And then on the other hand, there's the way that like technology has kind of altered, maybe not, I'm not going to be techno-deterministic and say it's completely changed it, but it has had some real effects on the way things go. In preparation for this episode and looking at the giant case of Austrian plagiarism going on in the news now that we're going to talk about in the episode, we've come across this plagiarism hunter, Mr. Stefan Weber, looking at this Google copy-paste syndrome. And he has some very interesting things to say in there. I don't know. Do you think, what are some great like STS, is there any STS theories and concepts that are working or any big kind of ideas in the field that we can use, you know, and mobilize as STS scholars and help really know about this subject to inform our own community?
Yeah, I would answer to that question on two levels. The first is, it's for me fascinating to see why people are so obsessed with plagiarism. That is interesting because that's the form of transgression which does least harm to the knowledge, because it steals, it repeats, it takes away credits from people. Yes, so that is, I'm not saying this is an innocent way of behaving or that shouldn't be followed, but I'm fascinating, I find it fascinating that we fix so much on that, because that's one of the cases where we can have a technological fix to a complex social problem. So we simply make this run through a machinery, and the machinery decides whether or not something is plagiarized. Now, this machinery is blind on several eyes. I mean, if you're clever and you use language borders, we have seen that in the case that when you have a plagiarism software that only works in your native language and somebody writes in a different language, then plagiarism software doesn't work. The same holds if I would copy from a rare language and just run it through a translation program and then overwrite it. I would still steal ideas from somebody, but I would not be caught by that software. But we seem to love technological solutions to social problems. And I think this whole debate of plagiarism is so interesting, because it seems the machine is we objectify a transgression and say, the machine tells me whether or not this is a problem. So this is more objective than if I would come in the lab and say, oh, the way how you do things is not actually as good as it should be. So then I could say, oh, she's so nitpicky on my methodology. I don't think that this is okay. And then I could have a discussion. Plagiarism seems so clear-cut, and we like to have the good, the bads. We don't like the ugly. So we don't have the three, we have the good and the bad, we don't have the ugly. And I think much of what's really going on is actually the ugly. The most interesting part from an STS perspective is the ugly. So to look at these little things that we do every day, that we think innocently are not as bad as that, the fact that we don't reflect on certain things, the fact that we take things or we exaggerate outcomes in specific ways, or we embellish graphs a bit more than it should be, or so. We seem that this is this little lie, you know, that this is an innocent lie nearly. And people would even say that you have to lie a bit because, or you have to exaggerate, let's call it like that. You have to exaggerate a bit because that's the way the world is, they say. You cannot, the science system is so competitive that if you want to be in the game, you have to behave like that. So there's a social excuse. That's why that worries me a bit, that we focus so much on plagiarism. And that seems the only way to think about science is to do copying. But that also allows to focus on a specific kind of science, namely the social sciences and the humanities. I mean, yeah. This is much less a concern for the physical sciences or for the life sciences, etc. Not that plagiarism doesn't happen there, because, of course, people write PhD theses and other things, and they also copy and paste things. But this is not seen as the core of the activity, the writing. It's more the result, the graphs, the data. So there the problem is much more lying in the aggregation of data and what you do along that process. And this is so difficult to transport to the outside that it's also maybe not so interesting for media to talk about it. And generally, I mean, one would have to do a study on what kind of PhDs do people have that go into politics, and why is it then that they are pointed at with these plagiarism cases? Because I cannot remember any case of a politician that is not accused of plagiarism, but of another kind of misconduct. So that is interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, you just don't see it.
Yeah, you don't see it, or nobody looks at it, because scientists would just not repeat findings of something that is irrelevant. So they would never look out for it. So maybe that's why we don't discover it, because if somebody doesn't find something that is worth knowing, then why would you control it? I mean, there have been beautiful cases of that people have been writing for years on things that never did a single experiment on, but because it was so unimportant to the community that nobody was interested in it. So the person could publish and just go through with it.
Yeah, I think, thank you for pulling us away from plagiarism and our hyper focus on that. That's really, really useful in these times. And it's really, to me, to use an expression, it's a needle in a haystack of a larger body of issues. And it's just it's something very easy for the media to focus on. And we've been circling around it for quite a bit, but I wanted to kind of take the opportunity here with Constantine and ask you about your own ongoing research in this field, definitely not of plagiarism, maybe it might include it, but of actual scientific practice. Can you tell us a little bit about your research that you're doing?
Yes. So we have been working on a project that was called Borderlands of Good Scientific Practice. And as the name already says, we did not start with a normative definition of what good science is, or good practice is, but we said practice always is on the move, and as science is on the move. And let me give you a little example just to explain what I mean by that. The moment you have sophisticated Photoshop programs that can, for example, work on images in science, journals had to define rules what kind of photoshopping is allowed to still be called an original image. That's a really interesting question. So what makes the proof in a scientific result? So you really, it's the these technological possibilities that force you to think about what is a good practice. And that needed a couple of years and a lot of heavily embellished Photoshop graphics or pictures until somebody said, hey, halt. This is actually not what we see. You have done so many layers of Photoshop that suddenly a phenomenon appears and is visible. And suddenly you realize that, okay, there is something going on. And nobody really did dig deep into it. And then journals made rules about how many layers of work are you allowed to do. So what we are interested in is actually when and where do people think about what practice means, etc. And for that purpose, we went into different locations, if you want so, and we looked at on the one hand, how young scientists think about the value environment in which they work. And we did develop a methodology for that purpose, because interestingly, as we said in the beginning of the podcast, it's totally not easy to talk about positive values of science. We are always about, what is not allowed, but we never speak to what is actually what drives us. Which values do we hold high? And so what we did is actually we invited them to do some ordering work and gave them a number of positive connotations of science and asked them to order in it personally with regard to their research. So which ones are the most important to them, et cetera. And so we learned that young scholars actually have a number of different, we call it value arenas. So they have different orientation networks when they judge a value. And so one is academia. So academia says, how does a career look like? When are you a successful PhD, et cetera? So they have these values. So they orient themselves there. Then they have what we call big science, and big with a big S. And so this is this ideal of science, like objectivity and et cetera. And okay. And then there is a science with small S. So that's the practices. And that's interesting. So they speak about diligence, about careful track keeping, about notebooks, about all these kinds of things. And then they also speak about societal values. So should I do research that is of worth to somebody outside myself? And that's yet another value. So we see actually that young people, when they move into science, they are confronted with sometimes contradictory regimes of values. Mm-hmm. And so the ideal of big science might not fit exactly with the career ideal and might not fit with, because they are under pressure, that they have to do fast something, etc. So we see this struggle, and that was is part of it, what we looked at. And so we have developed this methodology that runs across four sets of cards, where we invite them first to order positive values. Then we give them transgressions and we ask them which ones are relevant to them, to their work, because not all transgressions are relevant to all kinds of work. And as I said, plagiarism. Yeah, they immediately didn't say plagiarism, but said recognizing other people's work, which is a bit something different than plagiarism.
Yeah.
And then we had a discussion about what is about knowing that somebody has done something, but not mentioning it. What is that? Is that good practice or is it already a transgression? Or how can somebody prove that I knew it, but I did never mention it that I knew it, etc. So we had these wonderful discussions. Then we discussed about dilemmas. So what do I do if I have a paper accepted already and I realize that I really messed it up, the data? Do I say it or just do I think, okay, I'm near publication. Nobody will see that. Let's go. So what do I do and with whom would I speak? These kinds of things. And then we think with them about their institutional conditions under which they work. And I think that's an important part of reflecting that transgression is not located within the body of every single being, but it's located in a community and it's located in an institution. And I think that's the really important thing. And then we moved from the scientists. We went and we studied 40 years of debates in the journal Science and Nature, showing quite nicely how this idea of the self-correcting science has been put in question. And the self in the self-correcting is no longer solely the community, but has been enlarged by institutional actors like funders, like journals, like in universities or other research institutions that need to play an active role in thinking and reflecting and oversight of good practices. And I think that's the second thing, to see how this entanglement of science and society also caused a rethinking of what this self in self-correcting is. And finally, we also thought it's important to see how universities deal with these things. And so we looked into the guidelines of good scientific practice. That's a fascinating piece of writing, to be honest, because it tells you a lot about fantasies, but I'm not so sure that it tells you a lot about practices. And we did interviews with people who have caring within institutions for this. And what we kind of concluded is that it's much more, it's very formalized, and it's less about, and it's starting to be more about caring, but that's only gradually starting. That you need to more engage with people and less just have the rules. And if you transgress them, you get punished. This doesn't work, really. This doesn't work in an enterprise like science that is so socially collectivized, if you want. Right. So is so collaborative. So that is what we were after in our research. And I think what it nicely showed is actually that it is important to work. If we really believe that science is developing fast and is very innovative, why would we think we can have stable rules that are for eternity and why we need not adapt that to our practices? And I think that's for me, as an SDSer, I think practices in research have to go with practices of reflecting on research. So that is maybe the short note or shorthand for the long explanation.
No, thank you. I had the chance to look through the report that you delivered along with Florentina Franz. And one of the things that I was really struck by, and I kind of got it again while listening to you there, is it's kind of, you know, it seems plainly obvious to us, but not always to universities and to other administrations, this, you know, divide between actual situated practices and the guidelines. You know, you have a set of rules and how you should behave and you should produce research within these confines. But then we, you know, it starts off the report very plainly saying we know very, very little about what the practices are and what's taking place. For example, the really nice example you gave about, you know, what counts as an original image, what are the practices that we need to do and how these get established. So, you know, things that science with a big S, this ideal that we have, seems to have not changed so much, but science with a little S and the way things get done in actual situated practices and actual places is changing. And I think we're a little bit behind with how to, know about it, what's going on and informed with it. You know, if us, then certainly lay people who might still think of science with the big S idealized version, and then something happens, a transgression, and you know, it's very difficult to have that that divide.
And this is also attractive for science, maybe to have a certain storyline. And I was it was like cleaning the house, I call that, because you have this idea of the house of science, and then somebody does something which is not okay. So it's so interesting to see that most fraud cases always run according to the same scheme. Identify a single person if possible, because it's easier to say, oh, here is a rotten apple, and et cetera, et cetera. And or the black sheep or whatever they call it. They always have these wonderful metaphors for the single person that is very often described as psychologically disturbed, then et cetera, et cetera. And you have to expel it if possible, the person, and then the house is clean again. So this never leads to asking the more structural question. And I think the fact that we have these concerns now is actually a sign of structural problems. Because why did universities before 2004 not need any formal rules? Why did they not ask students to sign that this is the work they have done? I never signed that my PhD was the work I have done. Nobody thought that this was a thing one needs to do. Then we had a couple of really big cases, which, by the way, the universities first asked people just to leave silently. They wrote them nice letters, and the guys went to the next university and did the same thing there. So we did not want to tackle it. And suddenly it was so powerful and put in question so much of the beliefs of science that one said, okay, we need formal rules. And then you have really sometimes rules books that are 2-3 centimeters thick, explaining every little piece that you can do and what is the punishment for it. But at the end of the day, I don't think that this is a solution, because we are on the move and we have to have this kind of quasi-automatic reflexive way of dealing with it and saying, okay, this is a new method. What qualifies it as a good method? And kind of trying to spell out the tacit in some way and make it into an experience. And of course, in the social sciences, maybe the difficulty is also that the relationship between the sheer number of students supervised and the supervisors is in such a disbalance that this learning together is just not happening good in an intense enough way. So then this becomes a teaching situation. And I mean, teaching rules is always the second best, let me call it like that. It's good, but it's the second best. The best is to engage around it and to show and to work together, etc.
Yes, I would have a follow-up. And because I'm actually really interested in how you personally, Ulrike Feld, as a professor, deal with these issues. Like, how do you make sure you're researching and the people at the institute are researching with and adhering to good scientific conduct?
I personally think, you can never have a guarantee, just to be very clear about that. But you can assure that it becomes, the probability is very low. Because, of course, for example, you had this big case that somebody invented interviews this is very difficult to check out. If somebody says, I've done an interview and I can see a transcript, that would go very far to check that. But if you closely work with a person and you regularly see that person and see the progress of the work, you realize intuitively if something does not fit. And so I think most of the problems can be avoided by denser engagement processes and by putting questions of quality on the table right from moment one, even if it's stressful, et cetera, to ask questions and to reflect on why something is good enough or not good enough, and et cetera, et cetera. And we do that on different levels because, for example, if somebody does a master thesis as compared to a PhD, there are different rules in a sense. So what is good enough for a master's thesis in the sense like how big does a sample have to be able to say something, et cetera, is different. But then you also have to have the writing accordingly. So you cannot make the same kinds of claims on a very small sample than you can make on a bigger sample. So you have to be very careful in the language and in the claims you make, that some pieces of work are more exploratory while others can be more clearly hinting at certain indications, et cetera, et cetera. So language is, in the social science, our tool. And I think if you do accompany people well and you collaborate closely with them on their work, the chances of transgressions of good practice just get much smaller. I'm not never saying it doesn't exist, but I'm saying it gets really small. And that's what I meant before. Sometimes things happen where you think like, my goodness, I had a case of an MA thesis when handing it in, it came back with a plagiarism, with clear segments of plagiarism. And then we sat down and we studied what was plagiarized. And then I realized that this was a classical case where somebody has written reading cards while reading papers and then has forgotten to clearly indicate on these reading cards what he has lifted from the texts in his reflection or her reflection. And then when from this reading card, it went into the thesis, it was totally obvious that this was not an organized form of plagiarism. But then you have to study it and you have to see the pattern. And then you realize and have a conversation and it was just in two places, was totally not necessary, but was totally kind of visible that this was by error. Okay, so what can you take away that I warn people when they write reading cards to not forget to check whether or not they have really lifted parts of the text off the paper, because that is human, but that's human error. And that's why I think one has to make that difference. How much is it, in which ways? And when you carefully look at it, you can see what has happened and you can judge then whether or not it's simply take it back, clean that up, and hand it in again, which was the case here. That was a work of maybe half a day or something like that, because it was very clear that it was not about the argument or not mentioning the author or something like that. It was just a kind of slip. But it made me aware that one has to be all the time very explicit about pay attention to respect other people's texts, etc. And in particular, if you're a non-native speaker, as I am, for example, you read things and then you find, wow, this is such a perfect formulation. Yes, then you have to quote it. Then you cannot just lift it. And I mean, I had this discussion with students sometimes where they said, you can't say it better. And I said, yeah, maybe, but that's your problem. That's not the problem of the author. So you have to indicate that you can't say it better and you have to live with it. I'm sorry. I have to do that quite sometimes too. So, yeah. So I think it's learning about being open about your practices, about I'm always asking about processes and never only about outcomes. I carefully read the stuff. And I mean, I think I would sense very quickly if the writing does not conform by any means with the conversations I have. And then you can. But that's why I'm not worried about my direct environment, because I think we are very careful about these kinds of issues.
Yeah, thank you very much. And so we have maybe one last thing to discuss. Is there anything you would like to know that our listeners know about on scientific misconduct we haven't yet spoken about?
Actually, I think something that comes together with scientific misconduct is very often this question of credibility and trust. That is an important issue that people think, this happens all the time, and then why should we trust in science? I think we should realize that this happens actually quite rarely. I mean, when we talk about these things, this seems like this happens all the time. It doesn't. But at the same time, we have nevertheless to be attentive to it in order to keep the way science is done in a stable and sustainable position, in particular because contemporary societies rely a lot on that knowledge. And I think it's a debt towards society, I think, to produce knowledge in ways that it's robust, that it can stand up to checks and balances and to revisit it. And I think it's important that this should never be a question of trust, should never lead to a question of fundamental trust in a sense. Because, I mean, you know, it's social community, and social means transgression of boundaries, of rules, is something that is the most social that we have in the social. And we live in a society, and we live in Austria here, and I always say, why do people find it so unproblematic to take the newspaper on Sundays and not pay for it? Why do people think it's so unproblematic to not declare everything to the taxes? Why do they think that? And in that sense, at the same time, we have a lot of trust in our way of working, etc. And I think it is so important to not give too much space to this kind of scandalous thinking about science. Very often, the public scandals about scientists come up because there is some other interest to kind of point at a person or discredit a person, in particular when it is in the political realm. And we have seen that in Germany. We have seen it now in Austria. Yes, I do think people should take responsibility if they've done that. But I'm not sure that this really represents science in any decent way. So I think it's important to carefully think how trust relations are, how much checks and balances are built into science. And in general, to be very blunt, if the knowledge has some form of relevance in the world, it's generally also kind of found out over time. This does not excuse it, because we have cases where false results led to the fact that patients were treated in specific ways. And you don't want to be the patient that is treated according to a protocol that has been falsified. Or students have picked up the work of somebody, worked along for 2 years, and then to learn that they could not continue because that was all fraud. And we had that case with Jan-Hendrik Schön, who very clearly hundreds of PhDs had to stop their PhD projects and start something new. This is life course disrupting. And so it means something. So it's not an excuse we can have, but for the knowledge, for the knowledge kind of building is in itself on the medium and long term a quite robust building. This does not mean that we do not need to care for good practice, but it just means that there is a good network of control in place, and therefore, at least on the middle and long run, scientific knowledge has always been checked. It is something that is always changing. That's normal too, luckily, because otherwise we would not need science anymore if we anyway think it's all the same. So why should we have scientists spending their time doing new things? So we deeply believe that novelty is something inherent to science, and novelty also comes along with new questions of what is the border of good practice. And I think that's what I would say as a takeaway. We have to think it together.
Professor Ulrike Feld, thank you so much for your time and your insights that you gave us.
Okay, guys, so that was the interview with Professor Ulrike Feld from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at the University of Vienna. If you haven't heard enough yet and you still want to hear the discussion with a new team member, Nora, and Harry, Robbie, and me as well, be sure to check in with us in our next episode, which will appear shortly.